I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you so much for listening. I always say that, but I really mean it. It's an absolute joy to know the contact we have with our own audience and all you wonderful listeners who send us messages and all kinds of extraordinary things.
We do.
It's heartwarming. I know the subject matter's not always very cheerful, but it is genuinely heartwarming, and I feel it more than ever because I get such extraordinarily nice messages. This week, for example, I got an email from one of our listeners in Sweden pointing out that Peter Madsen, the submarine killer that we've done, had escaped from jail.
I had the same info on the old Insta.
Yeah, I funnily enough, had noticed. I was, you know, as usual, perusing the websites and seen the wonderful, fantastic pictures of him being captured. He'd hardly gone any distance at all, surrounded by armed policemen. It was a very striking picture. So it couldn't be said that Madsen had escaped altogether. But given his ingenuity, he is an extraordinary man.
Yeah.
Quite amazing.
Quite extraordinary.
Yeah. But the most important thing I think that I feel, I think I feel it more and more after 3 years or so of doing this, is that I feel a sense of connection, you know, real sense of connection.
Mm.
And Mo does that probably more than me because she monitors the Instagram.
I do monitor the Instagram. Look at this super cute pic I put up of this week of you and Betsy.
Oh, that's absolutely lovely.
Isn't that so nice?
Oh, that's so nice.
Everyone wrote very nice comments about it.
Oh, that's so kind. That's it makes an old man very happy.
Yeah, it was very sweet.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yes, we've had lots of nice messages, as ever. We're very grateful.
I couldn't tell you how grateful I am.
We are very grateful. We've got some new Patreon members. Thank you.
Yes.
People of Patreon. Geoffrey's going to read out your names.
Yes, of course. Oh, wonderful. New Patreon members called Diane, Charlie Reed, Samantha, William and Cinta Tantra.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. One and all.
We need a new bit of kit, don't we?
We do, because a bit of Molly's microphone has fallen off. So,
don't make us sound too chic. Try and stop.
No, well, I think it was... We just need to buy a tiny bit more kit.
Yeah, we're a bit...
We're on the kind of kit list. What have you been up to this week? I know you've been tier two.
We're on the back of an envelope. I have been tier two'd. So I have been at home.
I've been tier two'd. I've been out twice. Both times quite odd. I've noticed that a lot of places, I mean, I think my experience is different from yours, Mo. Mine, I'm right in the centre. I live in Bloomsbury and I can walk to Covent Garden very easily. And I notice that my bit is really, really quiet.
Yeah.
But yours isn't.
No. Bopping around where I am. Bopping.
It's like the graveyard here.
I went out for dinner last night and I sat outside to follow the instructions because I live on my own. So Geoffrey is in my bubble, but I'm
bubble free.
Yeah. So I don't have too much human connection. And then it was just very clear that the restaurant was full and nobody lived in the same house, I don't think. Or maybe they did. Who knows?
But we've talked about this ourselves, haven't we, this week? You know, that, okay, according to some of the big restaurateurs in London, Jeremy King, Richard Caring, you can have a business lunch with someone who isn't in your bubble.
Or in your house.
Or in your house.
As long as it's work.
But you can't have a social lunch. I find that very confusing.
Yeah. It is slightly confusing.
So I can't have that. I couldn't have lunch with Dan, my son, Molly's brother, because he's not in my household. But I could have lunch with him if I said that he was...
a business lunch. You could have lunch with your accountant, however.
I can have lunch with my accountant or my publisher, but I can't have lunch with my son. I find that very peculiar.
Yeah. I'm not sure the tier thing, the middle tier works that well.
Well, they're now talking about tier four.
Tier four?
Yes.
What's that?
It's gonna be
we all have to wear hazmat suits.
Yes. Tier four is already under discussion.
What's tier four?
Tier three, only worse.
Worse than tier three. Tier three is already pretty bad, isn't it?
Yeah, now they're going to shut all the pubs and restaurants.
Right.
Under four. Forget.
What about schools?
I think they're still trying to keep the schools open.
Well, I was talking to someone from the US last night and he was like, how's it all going over there? And I was like, it's just very confusing.
Well, I woke up in the middle of the night this week and I went to watch Trump-Biden.
Did you?
Yes, I saw about half an hour of it. I was fascinated.
Yeah, election time.
Yeah, it's not long.
Not long.
Not long.
There is a lot going on in the world.
There certainly is.
Anyway, on that note.
On that note, we should say that these two, we're going to do one this morning, which was suggested to us by Carol in May 2020.
Thank you, Carol.
And it's the story of Herbert William Wallace.
Are we calling it that, or what are we calling it?
I think we'll call it... it's actually the other way round. It's William Herbert Wallace. So I think we'll call it William Herbert Wallace.
Okay, well, here we go with William Herbert Wallace.
This is one of the most extraordinary and, in many ways, mysterious of all murder cases in British criminal history. It ticks a number of boxes, but it's almost always forgotten. Wallace was born in August 1878. He was the eldest of three children. He was born in Cumberland. Quite bright. Left school at 14, as everybody in those days did, and went to train as a draper's assistant. Basically working in a shop. Think of Grace Brothers and Are You Being Served?
Yeah, got it. That is a very niche reference, actually.
It is.
Although I know it.
Well, what it means is effectively he works in a store that sells drapery.
Fabric.
Fabric, all kinds of fabric. Can be clothing fabric, can be curtain fabric, can be bed linen.
My grandpa used to run a haberdashers.
Yes, he did. He eventually got a job in Manchester with Laidlaw and Company, who were actually rather grand, and they were official outfitters to the army and the diplomatic service and the colonial service. In 1903, after 5 years with Laidlaw and Company, he got a transfer to work in Calcutta, in India.
Hmm.
And in 1905, moved from Calcutta to Shanghai. Still with Laidlaw & Company, still doing the same basic job. And by this time, it was a lot of things to do with uniforms.
Yeah.
Okay. He returned to England in 1907, partly because he had a quite severe kidney problem. And in 1907, his left kidney was removed. And he was forever struggling with his kidneys for the rest of his life.
Understandable.
Then, quite unusually, he got a job working for the Liberal Party. Remember, the Liberal Party was a much stronger, bigger institution. They'd just been in government, the Lloyd George government. He was rose to the post of election agent in Harrogate in Yorkshire. In 1911. While he was there, he met a woman called Julia Dennis. Now, Julia Dennis was considerably older than Wallace. There's a great deal of confusion about exactly how much older she was. Some people say 7 years, some people say 11. I think she might even be 17 years older than he was. They married in 1914. Her father was an alcoholic. And came a farmer and came from Northallerton in northern Yorkshire. Neither of them were young. When Wallace married Julia, he was already 36. So she's a lady.
Same age as me, not young.
Yeah, sorry. That's not meant to be an insult. It was not young. But at the outbreak of war, of course, all elections were postponed. And so there was no job for being an election agent for the Liberal Party. There weren't any elections. So he got a job as a collection agent for the Prudential Assurance. Now, I should explain. Collection agents, I can remember collection agents. Every Saturday morning, a man from the Prudential used to knock on our door in North London and collect sixpence, old pence, that is, for the insurance policy. And you got a little pink book.
All right, that's sort of like an old-fashioned version of a direct debit.
That's right. Yeah, the man came order. Round. Man came round, knocked on the door.
And took sixpence for your insurance.
That's right. Yes, I mean, so that's basically what Wallace did.
Went round to people's houses and knocked on their door. Yeah, okay.
The couple moved to Anfield in Liverpool, very close, of course, to the football ground.
Mm-hmm.
Liverpool football ground, not to be confused with the Everton football ground. He was very competent at it. He was quite, you know, but believe it or not, he also lectured in chemistry at the Liverpool Technical College.
Cool, he's a jack of all trades, this chap.
And among other things, one of his hobbies was playing chess. Okay, so you've got this couple, no children, living in a house at 29 Wolverton Street in Anfield in Liverpool. She's quite a lot older than he is. He's perfectly respectable, upright. He's worth having a look at him.
Hold on a sec.
He looks almost like a perfect example of a Edwardian man, rather thin-faced, of course, a moustache.
Oh, yeah.
Wing collars, you know, high collars. Always wore a waistcoat, which, of course, I'm wearing today. I'm convinced I'm turning into my grandfather. Anyway, now begins what was to become one of the most sensational and mysterious murder cases in 20th century criminal history.
What happened?
On the 19th of January 1931, Wallace arrived at the Liverpool Central Chess Club to play a scheduled match. He wasn't an absolute everyday player, but he'd made a particular arrangement to play that night. When he got there, the chess club captain gave him a telephone message. Someone had rung him up and left a message at the chess club, which was held in a cafe in Liverpool, and said a man called R.M. Qualtrough of 25 Menlo Gardens East wanted to see him the following day at 7:30 in the evening about some insurance.
This literally sounds like you're telling me a Poirot or something. It's like Agatha Christie's here with me.
Wallace played the chess match, went home, and the following evening set off for Menlo Gardens East, another part of Liverpool. It took him 3 changes of tram to get there. When he got there, he discovered that there wasn't a Menlo Gardens East. There was a Menlo Gardens North, a Menlo Gardens South, and a Menlo Gardens West. But there wasn't a Menlo Gardens East. He asked several people, including, believe it or not, a bobby on the beat. "Where's Menlo Gardens East? I'm looking for Mr. Qualtrough." Nobody knew anything about it. He goes back home. He's walking around for about 3/4 of an hour. And finally, he begins the long trek back to Wolverton Street and his house. He arrives at the house, when, of course, his wife is indoors, and can't get in the front door. So he goes round. It's got a back entrance. You know, you may remember a lot of terraced houses, particularly in Liverpool, but in many places, had a privy in the back garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it also had a back door. Anyway, he tries to get in the back door, but doesn't manage it, and then sees two neighbours, meets them outside the back entrance to the house, and says, "I can't get in, and I know Julia's in there, inside. I'm really worried." So they say, "Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you give it one last try? We'll stick around and give you a bit of support." So he gives the back door one last try. This time, it opens. He goes inside, calls out, obviously, "Julia, where are you?" And finds her in the sitting room, having been beaten to death. A bludgeoned, 11 blows to the head.
With a blunt instrument.
Well, the instrument is still a matter of debate.
Okay.
The thing about Wallace is that he's incredibly calm. He was to remain calm throughout the events that followed. Wallace said to these two neighbours, "Oh, she's dead," in a rather sort of matter-of-fact kind of a way. In retrospect, looking back, I think that was simply his character.
Mm.
He wasn't given to hysterics or pulling his hair out or anything like that. He was born in 1878. He was stoic. He'd been...
buttoned-up Victorian.
Buttoned up in every way. Anyway, the police, let me put it this way, this is a sensation. I mean, you do not get a lot of murders at that point in respectable houses in Liverpool.
Mm.
And it becomes a sensation. The police convince themselves that R.M. Qualtro and William Wallace are one and the same man, because they discover that the message taken at the chess club was, the phone call was made from a telephone box about 400 yards from where Wallace lived. Wallace, they think, has contrived an extraordinary alibi, that hence going to see all those, asking everybody where Menlo Gardens East is, stopping a policeman. Now, up to a point, Lord Copper. But the difficulty is that Wallace, there's not a blood stain on him. And she's been brutally beaten.
Mm.
She's lying on a Macintosh, which has got a lot of blood on it. So the police come up with a theory that Wallace has taken all his clothes off, put on the Macintosh, beaten her to death, taken the Macintosh off, put his own clothes back on and gone out to find the mysterious Mr. Qualtro.
Right.
Unlikely, you might say. But nevertheless, by this point, Liverpool is in a frenzy. Someone has to answer for this dastardly crime. It's outrageous. You can see the headlines. We are talking about 1931, the beginning of the Depression. It's a very bleak time, and as they always do, murders do sell newspapers and continue to this day to do so. Wallace consistently denies any knowledge of the crime whatever. A local milk delivery boy says that he saw Julia about 6:45 on that particular evening, which wouldn't have given Wallace enough time to beat her to death, take all his clothes off, put them back on, go back out.
Take three trams,
go all the way to
Menlo Gardens East.
Wouldn't have had time.
Take three trams back.
The Prudential Staff Union, that his work still for the Prudential,
mm-hmm.
are so convinced that they organise a mock trial of Wallace on the basis of what they see as the evidence, and it finds him not guilty. So they support his defence.
Okay.
Wallace goes on trial. The evidence was almost entirely circumstantial. with the exception of the fact that they do, the milk delivery boy does enter the witness stand. The difficulty is that Wallace is incredibly controlled. He sits in the dock. I've just written down some of the contemporary descriptions. His composure was shocking. Someone said, was it callousness? Was it indifference? Was it confidence? Well, I think it's an extraordinary, nevertheless, that the judge, summing up to the jury, summed up for an acquittal. He pointed out that if there was any reasonable doubt of Wallace's guilt, they should find him innocent. And also said that the murder could have been committed by some unknown criminal. The jury were not convinced. It took them 1 hour to convict William Herbert Wallace. And he was duly sentenced to death.
Oh dear.
Now comes even more, another extraordinary event. The Court of Appeal, which had been recently created in May 1931, considers the case and reverses the judgment. They said that the conviction on the grounds, it was not supported by the weight of evidence.
I mean, that's fair.
This is a truly remarkable event. Nowadays, a Court of Appeal would never overturn a verdict of the jury. I mean, it takes forever to overturn a jury verdict.
Mm.
But to summon the case and turn over a jury was truly unique, a remarkable turn of events. Wallace, and again, if you look at some pictures of him,
mm-hmm.
you will see him being ushered out of the Court of Appeal with a man on either side of him. He was obviously shocked.
Yeah, I see that one.
Yeah. I'm afraid things didn't go well. Wallace went back to work, but was subjected to what can we now call trolls, hate mail, all kinds of things. And he's in his mid-50s. He's never been in good health. His kidneys are still bad.
Mm.
And he had to move away from Wolverton Street. Anyway, on the 26th of February 1933, barely 2 years after the appeal had been upheld and was freed, he died of urine poisoning and kidney failure.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the old problem had come back. No one was ever charged with the murder, and it remains unsolved. Wallace was buried alongside Julia in the cemetery in Liverpool. And if you can go, and still see the stone.
I see it on the interweb.
You know, saying
that's
William and
remarkable.
Julia.
Remarkable.
So who killed her?
What do you think?
Well,
tell us your theories.
Well, there are plenty of theories. One in particular concerns a man called Richard Gordon Parry. Now, Parry was only 22 in 1931. He had a lavish lifestyle, which he seemed to sustain by stealing money. At one point, he'd collected some of the monies for Wallace. Wallace was busy, and Parry had gone out to collect for him. And so it's said, Wallace realised that Parry was actually not giving him all the money. Now, Wallace, as many collection agents did, kept quite a lot of the proceeds week on week.
In his house?
In a cash box in his house.
Ah.
Certainly, Parry knew Julia. I mean, he'd been to see Wallace and his wife in the house.
Yeah.
Blood was found on a glove in Parry's car. And the night after the killing, he specifically washed his car, hosing it down.
It could have been that someone moved Julia in there on the Macintosh, which is why there was no blood in the house.
Yes. Parry had a girlfriend who gave him an alibi for the night of Julia's killing.
Interesting.
Which was later proven to be false.
False.
What was his motive? Well, it could have been robbery. He always stoutly denied it. Could it have been... I've seen one theory that Parry had an associate and it all went terribly wrong. And the associate, whom we've never named or don't know, killed her in a fit of rage. It's one of the most extraordinary cases.
It's like something out of Agatha Christie.
Yes. Wallace, you see, had no motive whatever for killing Julia.
I just, in my gut, I feel like it wasn't Wallace.
And Parry, who has been named over the years in a radio documentary, in a book, died in 1980 and insisted that he had nothing to do whatever with the crime. Who killed Julia Wallace? And was William Herbert Wallace really guilty? Or was he truly innocent? Remains one of the most interesting and unusual murder cases in the 20th century. Because it is like an Agatha Christie.
It's so thing to call up and give the name Mr. Quarry and say...
Quattro.
Quattro. And go to... Menlo Gardens East.
It's. Who did that then? If it wasn't Wallace, was it Parry? Why did they do that?
They wanted to get him out of the house.
Wanted to get him out of the house.
Otherwise, yeah. He's getting himself out of the house.
Yes.
And it does seem an elaborate alibi to make for yourself.
Yeah.
If you're.
And Wallace. Why would you? Why would you? Stop two neighbours and say, I can't get into the house.
Why would you premeditate? I mean, she was very beautiful, Julia. I'm sure there's no reason why he would want to kill. There was no sign their relationship was on the...
No, none at all.
He had no reason to kill.
No.
There's no motive.
And the police did take a look at Parry at the time, but dismissed him because of the false alibi.
Well, poor old Julia and poor old Wallace.
Yeah.
William Herbert Wallace.
Yes. But it's an absolutely stunning case.
I love that one.
It's
who suggested that? What was the lady's name?
Very nice lady called Carol.
Carol, thank you for that. That's right up my street, as you well know.
Yeah.
That's really my bag.
That's very much...
That's absolutely my jam.
Forget serial killers.
Yeah, I'm not as keen on anyone born in the Victorian times. I'm down.
Well, you asked for a Victorian one, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did. Oh, that was great. Thank you so much. Okay, so that was William Herbert Wallace.
Yes, it was. And I do think it's one of those cases that sticks in the memory.
It's a good one.
Dear.
Who killed Julia Wallace?
Hmm.
Super. Well,
there's been lots of over the years, a lot of speculation.
Yeah, I bet.
But I think the judge may have been probably righter than a lot of people have given him credit for when he said it could have been done by some unknown criminal who knew that there was a cash box in the house.
Yeah.
But the cash box wasn't stolen.
Oh. Well, that is confusing.
Yeah.
Well... Feel free to do your own research, listeners.
Yes.
Send us your thoughts.
There is a very famous photograph of Julia in front of the fire.
Yes, I see it on the internet.
Yeah, it's very famous.
Do send us your thoughts. We have an email address, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com. You can Instagram us, tweet us, bloodties_pod. Instagram, you get me, obviously. And you can go to Jeffrey's website.
Yep.
And contact him that way.
Which is currently being updated.
Oh, is it now?
With new podcast material.
Full of new pics.
Full of new pictures and things.
Pics and podcasts.
But we've brought all the podcasts up to date.
Oh, excellent. Well done, you.
All 104. So far. 104. This is the 104th, I think.
That's a lot of podcasts, isn't it?
So it's all being done. So you can always find me that way too. So, and some listeners are very good. They they email me, because you could, I've got an email contact on the website.
Yeah, you can get direct to the source.
And they email
so
me.
So you can get to either of us, basically.
Yep. Well, and we're going to do Crime Con next summer, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to Crime Con.
Which is a big deal.
Yes, we're very thrilled. Yes. I feel very glamorous. Oh, and also they put our Crime Con video on Instagram this week.
Good day.
Yeah, I'll show it to you in a bit.
Goodness.
Very glamorous. Feel free to buy a ticket. You can get a discount if you use the code BLOOD.
Yes.
When you purchase it.
Good code, isn't it? BLOOD.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Let there be blood.
Excellent.
So we've got, you know, and we were talking about whether or not we should have a break. How do you think we should stop in a bit? Or?
We're going to have a break. We're going to do one more and then we're going to have a little break.
Okay.
It's a petty break.
Yes, I don't want to leave the listeners
for
very...
We won't leave you for too long, I promise.
For very long.
Jeffrey worries about you.
I do. I worry about myself, but I certainly worry about the listeners. Yeah. And, it's very important.
I know. You are very important to us, but sometimes you need a little petty break.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of the reasons we've been doing slightly different things recently is I'd had an absolute rush.
We've had a slew, hadn't we?
I had an awful early or early autumn.
Jeffrey had had a dam opened on him of death, and it was just too much. Hence the books and the slightly more light-hearted, if we can say that.
Yeah.
Story just to end this season, and then we'll have a little break, and then we'll get right back in there, guys, with the stuff you really like.
Yes, we had one listener who didn't like the books. She wanted more death.
More death.
Yes. I hope she likes William Herbert Wallace.
Back to death. Here we go. All right. Well, thank you very much. As usual, thank you so much to our producer, Sam Brain. She's a genius. To Audio Boom for hosting us. My brother Dan, who did the music. My friend George, who drew our caricature. To Jeffrey for all of your hard work. Thank you. And to the listeners.
And to the listeners. And I think I, as always, believe I should thank you, Mo, because this was your idea. And without you, it would be impossible. But as I always say, and Julia Wallace demonstrates, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.